One is here. I think I've seen him. And then CAZ, I've seen him, is here. And then Malakase is here, just behind. He's sitting like a security officer. Then we have got Riaz Musa, is here, distributing documents. Then we've got Sam Mandiwane. This time is not a parliamentary liaison manager. This one is a parliamentary liaison officer. Yes, I think that those that deal with organograms, they know. and the pay packages. Okay, and Mandla, Madunisa, is here. Okay. Then who am I meeting? Any potkita? He's on. Then am I missing anyone on the delegation now from Home Affairs? None. Then we've got, I think, apologies from the Director General as well as Mr. McKay. They're supposed to be here. And Mr. McKay, of course, is directly affected. And then they've apologized, and then we hope that they have communicated everything that they will say to the team that is in front of us. We are actually going to receive a presentation on the Refugees Amendment Bill. And like as I said, if it is possible, Deputy Minister, then if we just get a statement that says what is the intention of this amendment bill, that's the nutshell without actually talking to the nitty gritty. So that we just simply put something there and say, no, that's where we're going. And then now we follow, then we now follow the presentation, knowing where it is taking us to. And if you are ready, you can take us on this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I see you're really urging me to do in a nutshell what you've seen that document do in about 30 pages. Let me just firstly say that you did miss Advocate Gaum, who's also here. And maybe perhaps I could just introduce Advocate Henny Potgieter properly, because he has been specifically contracted to assist us with this piece of legislation. So he will be with the committee as the committee processes the bill as far as possible. This bill is has been in the making for about 2 years now. And so if the Portfolio Committee expects a quick rundown, I'm afraid I'm going to have to disappoint you. But let me just say, Chairperson, that if we do not finish the briefing today, we're very, very willing to come back and follow up. The reason why I've been very, very keen, this is now the third draft of this presentation that the team has done to the Portfolio Committee. I've been very, very keen that the Portfolio Committee must be placed with all and any information to enable them to be best placed to draft these amendments, because the legislature is the highest lawmaking authority. And unfortunately, you will see in the presentation that much of what has gone wrong with our laws dating back to 2008 and 2011 has been because, again, there wasn't attention to detail. And it's in this regard that I'd rather the Portfolio Committee take its time to finalize this particular piece of legislation than make those mistakes that cropped up when we tried to just meet deadlines the whole time. And while these amendments are very, very important to take us through some of the challenges that we currently face in asylum, some of which you are very, very familiar with, such as the abuse of the system, and this is part of what the amendments hope to address and to curtail, the issue of corruption, you will find in the legislation a very important theme of anti-corruption, and we hope that we will get your support. We also hope to ensure that there are increased efficiencies with this legislation. So one example will be that you would know that our courts have said that, for example, the Refugee Appeal Board, as well as the Standing Committee on Refugee Affairs, have to sit on block. So there's a quorum that they have to use to sit to decide one case. What we're trying to establish, and in fact what has happened practically, is that each one of those members are in fact legally qualified. And there's no reason for them to have to sit on block, which then undermines the efficiencies with which they can then finalize cases, etc. Especially because these are internal appeals and internal reviews, meaning that you still have a court case that could potentially arise thereafter. So that's another aspect that this legislation hopes to untangle in terms of improving our efficiency. The legislation is also aimed at rectifying what has gone wrong in the 2008 and 2011 bills and acts that have been passed but have been found to be unimplementable, and you'll see that Advocate Erasmus will deal with that in some depth so that you gain an understanding of exactly what transpired and why it is that certain things could not be implemented and why we want to do certain things with this piece of legislation to address some of those issues as well. So with those few words, Chairperson, I want to hand over to Dion. Dion will, in strategic places in the presentation, pass on to me again, and I will pass back on to him, just to give you some insights that we hope to share with you in order to equip you to deal with what we propose in a proper manner. Thank you, Chairperson.
Now
you're welcome. You may proceed. Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honourable Members. Good morning. Just going on from where the Deputy Minister said, we're going to start out the presentation just by dealing with the background to the Refugees Amendment Acts of 2008 and 2011. And just to put up front that the intention with the 2016 Amendment Bill that we have now is also to bring into operation the 2008 Amendment Act as well as the 2011 Amendment Act with the necessary changes that had to be made. So what happened in 2008 and 2011, there were Refugee Amendment Acts that were prepared where they were sent to and signed by the President. So they are in the statute book, but they're not in operation as yet. And I'll indicate why. If we look at the 2008 Refugees Amendment Act, what that act seek to do was to deal with, amongst others, the dissolution of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs and the Refugee Appeals Board, and to create then one entity called the Refugee Appeals Authority, which was done. What then happened during the deliberations in the Portfolio Committee meetings, etc., the intention was that the Refugee Appeals Authority will deal with both the appeals and reviews. Based on the deliberations that took place, is that the committee felt that the reviews for decisions by RSTOs that are manifestly unfounded, abusive or fraudulent, should however still be dealt with, not the SCRA, because we're dissolving SCRA, but by the DG, and that the Refugee Appeals Authority should still be dealing with your appeals. Now what happened in that, so there was an amendment that took place during the parliamentary process, and because of that there was an incorrect cross-reference that slipped in later in the bill, which made it basically unimplementable because it was referring to an incorrect section in the Act. So that's one of the things that we're wanting to correct now as well, that has been corrected actually. So what happened is the incorrect reference to Section 243B in Section 24 capital B of the 2008 Amendment Act meant that the Amendment Act could not come into operation, and we're correcting that now. So what happened in 2011, this was corrected. We corrected that incorrect cross-referencing, And we further introduced in the 2011 Amendment Act the term Refugee Status Determination Committee to do away with your Refugee Status Determination Officers. This meant that there would be a committee sitting and deciding on decisions whether or not refugee status should be granted, meaning at least two or three people need to sit in that committee to form a quorum to make decisions. I'll also hand over to the Deputy Minister, because that proves to be unimplementable, and also due to lack of funding, etc., as one of the reasons that we had, we could not implement that specific section. But I know Deputy Minister wants to elaborate on that specific issue as well. Thanks.
Let me just say that when it comes to the determination of asylum seekers' status, we have a model where officials called the Refugee Status Determination Officers make those decisions. In other words, they process the application. What happened in 2011 was that we were in a very difficult situation in terms of administration of refugee matters. You know, on average, it took 6 years for an application to be finalized. And with the numbers that were coming through the system in 2011, and you would have seen that when the stats were presented to you, Chairperson, that we had a huge number of intake of new applications in that year. The system was grinding to a halt. You couldn't add more RSDOs because you simply didn't have the money. But even if you did, the efficiency level were just completely compromised. So what we did in 2011 was that we changed the system. We cut our losses with regard to the old application. And we said we will now start setting benchmarks for every RSDO that when new applicants come into the office, they will be prioritized, firstly. Secondly, their applications must be finalized within 3 months maximum. It took us quite a long time to achieve this, but achieve it we did. And for the last 4 years, we have managed to achieve this benchmark. So efficiency is a very, very important aspect of dealing with this mechanism of the RSDO. But equally of concern is the quality of the decisions that your RSDOs make. Because it doesn't help that you have a quick turnaround of applications, but your decisions are so poor that they're constantly having to be reviewed and overturned and so on, because that doesn't help anybody. The third issue was relating to potential corruption. You would know, Chairperson and members, that we constantly get told that there's a lot of corruption happening at our refugee reception centers, etc. And ultimately, if you think about it, the point at which somebody's status is determined is probably the most vulnerable point in terms of potential corruption, because obviously people want to get status. Now, these three factors, the issue of efficiencies, quality of decisions, as well as corruption, factored into this notion of status determination committees prior to 2011. And the status determination committees essentially meant that instead of one person taking a decision, there would be at least three people. Three people dealing with one case. That would address quality, and that would address the issue of corruption, because it's very difficult to corrupt three people. But what it wouldn't address is efficiency, because all you need is for one person to be ill, people to resign, and your institution just grounds to a halt. And particularly when you're having to deal with 170,000 new applications per annum, it's crazy. So we intervened at the point of the National Assembly at that stage, but unfortunately that legislation had already reached a point of completion where the Portfolio Committee felt, look, we had been sold on this idea by your department. We are not going to now turn back. So they continued with the legislation, including the Status Determination Committee. For its part, the department did, however, after the legislation was passed, try to implement the model of the Status Determination Committee. The idea was, let's try a model of it in one of the refugee centers. Let's see. I mean, we suspect the efficiencies are going to be compromised, but let's see. Unfortunately, there was just no resources made available to us for this. I think everybody, including Treasury, could see that this was not a workable model, and they were not going to throw good money after a bad idea. So that's really the history behind why we are now saying to the Portfolio Committee, together with some of the changes we have made in the refugee reception centers to address the issue of corruption as well as the issue of quality of decision, why we need to revert back to the model of the single refugee status determination officer, but with checks and balances, both in terms of quality and potential corruption.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Chairperson. So based on this, what then happened, this led to the drafting of the current bill that we have that's currently before Parliament, the 2016 amendment, Refugees Amendment Bill. And obviously what we wanted to do in this regard was to do away with the Refugee Status Determination Committee, as we indicated, it was established in the 2011 Refugees Amendment Act, and to retain the Refugee Status Determination Officers that we currently have. But the further thing that we did, we also took opportunity to address certain practical challenges that we were faced regarding the management of asylum seekers and refugees. We're all aware of the courts, and correctly guided by the Constitution, when they interpret the Refugees Act and regulations, but they sometimes tend to make certain decisions that favor asylum seekers, but regardless of the practical consequences that these judgments have for the department on a practical level. One of these cases that we can mention is the Wachinuka case, and this gave rise to an interpretation by the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs that asylum seekers should be allowed to work and study pending the finalization of their applications for asylum. So this became something like as of right. If you're on a Section 22 permit, you can work and study. And that was never the intention. The intention was to say, look at each and every case on an individual basis. So what we then do is the right to work and study, based on the Wachinuka case, became basically what we call a pull factor for your economic migrants, who then clog the asylum seeker system, which then further results in certain inefficiencies, etc. So if regard is had to the main objectives of the Refugees Amendment Bill of 2016, and what we're trying to do is obviously we amending and inserting and deleting certain of the definitions. We're also making provision that relates to the disqualification from refugee status and losing of such status by individuals. We're also providing for measures to combat fraud and corruption, as alluded to by the Deputy Minister earlier, and your refugee reception officers, as well as the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs and the Refugee Appeals Authority. We're also omitting and deleting provisions that were referring to your Refugee Status Determination Committee, as we've already discussed. That's being replaced. We're retaining the Refugee Status Determination Officers. We're also substituting certain provisions relating to the Refugee Appeals Authority to make it more efficient, effective in its operations and functioning. We're providing for the re-establishment of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, and also to confer certain additional powers on the Standing Committee, because in terms of the 2011 Amendment Acts, that's where the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs was taken away. It was dissolved. We're bringing it back. We're reinstating it now. We're also conferring certain additional powers on the Director General, and also to clarify the procedure relating to conditions to asylum seeker visas and the abandonment of applications. Also, revising provisions relating to the review of asylum applications, the withdrawal of refugee status in respect of certain categories of refugees. We're also looking at providing certain additional offences and penalties, and then obviously matters that are connected with this. In general, Chair and Honourable Members, When we look at the functions of officials, the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs and the Refugee Appeals Authority throughout the bill, we capture them together and we just want to make that clear up front. If you look at your refugee status determination officers, what they will do is they will consider the applications and then they've got certain where they may grant asylum based on the information provided to them, reject such an application as manifestly unfounded or just unfounded. Now, if an application is rejected as manifestly unfounded, there's an automatic review to SCRA, which leads us to the second one here. SCRA must then review that specific decision if it's rejected as manifestly unfounded. Earlier, as we indicated, that decision was given to the DG, but we brought it back now again to say that SCRA must remain doing that specific function. We've added certain things to say that they may also monitor and supervise other decisions of the RSDOs, including the decisions to grant asylum, reject applications on the basis of being unfounded. In this regard, Section 11 of the current Act, as we have it, included a quality assurance process regarding the decisions of RSDOs, but that fell away when the amendments were done. We're bringing a certain number, and we're reintroducing it. As far as the Refugee Appeals Authority is concerned, they must consider appeals against decisions where applications were rejected as unfounded by your refugee status determination officers, and I want to add whether applicants exercise the right to bring an appeal. It's not automatic like in the case of your Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. Chair, if we look at drilling down onto the objects that I've mentioned, if we look at Section 1 relating to the definitions, which is Clause 1 of the bill, there we looked at dependent and we said that we need to amend the definition of dependent in order to limit dependence to minor children of asylum seekers or refugees, whether they were born in or prior or after the application for asylum, and then also to spouses and destitute age or infant parents of an asylum seeker or refugee. And what we're trying to do here, all of them must be included in the specific application. So when a specific individual applies for asylum, he or she has an obligation to indicate each and every of these members that are dependents of him or her, whether they are in the country or still abroad, etc. They need to, there's an obligation on them to do that. Currently what we have is an unmarried child and members of the immediate family. That's what we're using currently, the terms we're using. They also qualify for dependent status, and in our view this just casts the net much too wide. So what we're saying is nothing precludes these other dependents that fall within these categories from applying for asylum or refugee in their own right, if they do that. Okay. Then we're looking at the definition for immediate family. What we've done, we've deleted this definition because it follows from the first thing that I've just explained now, where immediate family is being deleted because of the adjustment to the definition of dependent, as I just mentioned earlier. Permit, we're changing to what we call the visa. And why? Because in terms of the Immigration Act, we talk about visas now, no longer permits. You don't have temporary residence, so we call it a visa. So you'll have an asylum seeker visa now, not asylum seeker permit. Marriages, they were just amended to omit the reference to Islamic law and rights, as the Act already makes provision, and you'll see in paragraph A, for a marriage concluded in terms of the rights of a foreign country. So if it's accepted in that specific country, then we accept that it's not necessary to specifically mention that in the Act. Obviously, we're also inserting a definition now for Standing Committee because it was deleted in terms of your 2011 Amendment Act, so we're reinserting it now. And the only way in which you can do that, Chair, is by means of a legislative amendment. Hence, we're doing it now. The definition of your status determination committee is being deleted because we are doing away with your refugee status determination committee. If we turn to Section 4 of the Act, it's Clause 2 of the bill that deals with Section 4, and it relates to the disqualification from obtaining refugee status. And what we've done there is we've added certain things. So our courts do recognize, as I've indicated earlier, that every sovereign nation has the power to, for instance, forbid the entrance of foreigners within its denominations or to admit them only in such cases and upon such conditions as it may see fit to prescribe. Now, in an attempt to further limit the large number of undeserving individuals seeking asylum in South Africa, and this is where we're looking at economic migrants, etc., the following additional disqualifications have been included. So in other words, there are already three or four there. We are including these ones that are being mentioned here in the current in the bill. If the person has committed a crime involving torture, as defined in the Prevention and Combating of Torture of Persons Act 2013, if the person has committed a crime in the Republic that's been listed in Schedule 2 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, or if the person has committed a crime that's punishable by imprisonment without the option of a fine, if the person has committed an offence in relation to fraudulent possession, acquisition, or the presentation of an ID card, passport, travel document, temporary residence visa, or a permanent residence permit, and these two are in terms of the Immigration Act. If the person is a fugitive from justice in another country where the rule of law is upheld by a recognized judiciary. Obviously, if the person entered the Republic other than through a designated port of entry and fails to give compelling reasons why he or she so entered the country. Remember, the idea is that a person must enter the country at a port of entry. At the port of entry, and we'll get to this a bit later on, you will be issued with a Section 23 visa in terms of the Immigration Act, and that visa will obviously allow you to travel to the nearest refugee reception office within a period of 5 days in order to submit your application for asylum. And the last one that we mentioned is if you fail to apply for asylum within the 5-day period after having entered the Republic in the absence of compelling reasons, which I've just alluded to. Chair, looking at Section 5 of the current Act, which is now Clause 3 of the bill, it deals with the loss of refugee status, and we're also just adding certain things that's already currently captured there, we're just adding to that. If a person has acquired refugee status and obviously mindful of the principle of sovereignty, the following additional grounds for losing that status, we have included that. One, if the person avails himself or herself in any way of the protection of his or her country, or returns to visit such country, because we've got instances where we find that people have returned to their country or they go to their embassies to get to them and they reavail themselves, but they still remain on the, and we're saying if that happens, it's reavailment, a person should lose your status in that regard. Obviously, if you've committed a crime in the Republic, and we also mentioned that, it basically mirrors what we said earlier, that's listed in Schedule 2 to the Criminal Law Amendment Act, or if it's a crime that's punishable by imprisonment without the option of a fine. Also, if the person has committed an offence in relation to fraudulent possession, acquisition, and presentation of ID card, passport, travel document, temporary residence visa, or permanent residence visa, and then if the minister, after consultation with cabinet, resolves to seize the recognition of refugee status of any individual refugee or category of refugees, or to revoke such status. I don't know if Ian wants to add a few things on this specific. Chair, turning to Clause 4 of the bill, which amends Section 7 of the Act, which deals with the delegation of powers. What we're endeavouring to do in this clause is to expand certain powers that may not be delegated by the minister. For instance, if you've got the right to make regulations, the minister cannot delegate that power to the DGs and to make regulation. That's a power. So we've just expanded that. We've also looked at the heading of Chapter 2 Clause 5, and relating to Clause 5 of the bill, and we've changed that we've amended that in order to provide for the re-establishment of SCRA. Remember, we said SCRA is no longer there. We're re-establishing SCRA now, and that because SCRA was dissolved in 2008. If we look at Section 8 of the Act, it's Clause 6 in the bill, we're looking with the establishment of your refugee reception officers. Refugee reception officers in the sense of not officers with an R, it's refugee reception of the buildings and stuff itself. What happened is the DG is empowered to both now establish and disestablish refugee reception officers in order to address the previous challenges. What we had currently in the legislation that the DG may declare any as a refugee reception office, but there's nothing in the legislation that says that the DG can also disestablish, and we're just bringing that to the fore, making it clear that the DG can also disestablish a refugee reception office. Sections 8A to J, which is clauses 7 to 12 in the bill, specifically deals with the Refugee Appeals Authority. So we've looked at the practical experiences that the Refugee Appeals Authority has. Currently it's known as the Refugee Appeals Board, but once this bill is enacted and comes an Act of Parliament, it will be called the Refugee Appeals Authority. And we're looking at to introduce certain further things in order to address certain of these operational issues. One of the things, and Deputy Minister has already alluded to that, is that all the members of the Refugee Appeals Authority will be legally qualified. And their number is to depend, obviously, on the volume of work that they do. And you'll see later on when it comes to the appointment of members, it can be for a certain period, it can be for an interim period, it depends on the volume of the work that we have. And these members, very importantly, may also consider these appeals individually. So they may sit on an individual basis when they look at the appeals. These members are appointed for a period not exceeding 5 years at a time, and such member may be reappointed for a number of additional periods, not exceeding 5 years at a time, and we're also allowing for a situation where you can do periodic appointments if circumstances so require. Currently, we have a situation where if you make an appointment, the appointment is for a period of 5 years. Sure.
This clause is particularly important, members. It may not seem so and it may seem technical, but if you recall, currently we have a huge backlog with the Refugee Appeal Board. We've been in discussions with the UNHCR to come to the party and to assist with this backlog. However, if you look at the current legislation in terms of the appointments that we are able to make in the Refugee Appeal Board, you can only appoint somebody for 5 years. You can't appoint somebody for 2 years. You can't appoint somebody for 7 years. We don't mind the 7 years, but what we do mind is if the UNHCR were to give us funding to appoint, let's say, 20 Refugee Appeal Board members, we should be able to appoint them for a year or two, as opposed to 5 years. So we're really pleading for flexibility here. It also gives us a lot of difficulties. One of the first difficulties you would imagine, Chairperson, is when somebody's term of 5 years comes to an end. But then I'm told as Deputy Minister, no, he's got about 200 cases which are part heard. Now, part heard matters are really a problem of efficiency. I wouldn't want to extend this person's contract for another 5 years simply because he's got part-heard matters. This person should have managed himself and his caseload or her caseload better. But I'm caught in a quandary. I can't appoint the person for 6 months and say, finish your part-heard, because the law says 5 years and that's all. So I'm forced, in a sense, to consider whether I should appoint the person for 5 years. As it happens, in some matters, I've refused to appoint this person again because the person has shown themselves to be inefficient. But then what happens with the part-heard matters is somebody has to start all over again. And that's the consequence of it. And so that's why we're pleading for this maximum flexibility in this piece of legislation while ensuring that people are legally qualified.
Thanks, dear. We're also looking at additional disqualifications from serving as a member that have been added, such, for instance, as the removal, if you've been removed previously from your previous office because of fraud, theft, corruption, also refusal to submit to a vetting investigation or failing such a vetting investigation. We're also saying that members must be South African citizens. But there's a qualification now to say that foreigners may be appointed if they have expertise that would significantly enhance the capacity of Refugee Appeals Authority. And this is something, obviously, that lies within the discretion of the minister in terms of the conduct that we have now. The minister may also then summarily remove a member if he or she so becomes disqualified, as mentioned above. Now, previously the provisions on vacancies were there to say that if a person resigns, the minister may appoint any other person for the unexpired period of that portion. But now, in view of the fact that we've made provision for these periodic appointments, this falls away. We're deleting that from the Act now. Chair, if we look at sections 9A to 9H, which is clause 13 of the bill, it deals with the re-establishment of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. As I indicated earlier, because it was deleted early in the 2011 amendment, we have to bring it back by means of a legislative amendment, which we're now doing in the 2016 amendment bill. What we've decided to do is to also grant additional powers that are conferred on SCRA, and mainly these powers are to review decisions of your refugee status determination officers in the case where applications are manifestly unfounded, abuses, or fraudulent, but then also to monitor and supervise decisions made by RSDOs granting asylum, or where they found application to have been unfounded, which where the applicants can then come and you know request an appeal to the Refugee Appeals Authority. They're also there then to advise the Minister and DG on matters that are referred to them by the Minister and the DG. And we're also including an additional thing to say that they must provide advice on the training of members of staff, which is important for us. Basically, if you look at the appointment and of members of SCRA, the composition, the terms of office, what we've tried to do, what we did in terms of the Refugee Appeals Authority is mirrored in the provisions relating to the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, meaning they can sit as individual members, they're legally qualified, etc., etc. If we turn to section 20A, which is a new section that we're inserting in the Act, or wanting to insert in the Act, which deals with crime prevention and integrity measures, it's clause 14 of the bill. Now, as Deputy Minister has indicated, in order for us to deal with the scourge of corruption that's experienced amongst officials and also other operatives within the ASM system, there's recently also been a focus on a television program in this specific regard, where it was indicated that corruption was highlighted, etc. The following new provisions are suggested to be included in the bill when it becomes an act. A procedure for integrity testing of staff members at any refugee reception office, which would include persons who are not members of the staff but who perform any functions at such an office. And then also any members of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs as well as the Refugee Appeals Authority. All members of the staff must, after the commencement of this Act, and we're also saying from time to time thereafter, undergo integrity testing as a measure to combat or prevent fraud, corruption, or any crime of which dishonesty is an element. Now, any information that is gathered in terms of Section 20A2, in other words, the information I mentioned above, may be utilized for criminal, civil, or disciplinary proceedings, and they can also further use that as evidence subject to the admissibility of such information as evidence. Information may also be used to institute a vetting investigation in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act of 1994. What we're wanting to say as well is that the refusal to submit to a vetting investigation or failing such an investigation would, in the case of public servants, and we say here public servants, lead to disciplinary measures. In the case of your SCRA and your Refugee Appeals Authority members, a refusal or failure would obviously lead to a dismissal. That's what we're trying to say, because your integrity is of utmost importance in these entities. Chair, if we turn to clause 15 of the bill, which deals with amendment to section 21 of the current Act relating to measures in respect of asylum seeker applications. Once again, we're saying here, in order to address certain of the practical challenges that is faced within the asylum seeker management system, and also in an attempt to distinguish well-intentioned asylum seekers from others, i.e. economic migrants, etc., we wish to introduce the following as additions. Asylum seekers, they are required to apply within 5 days of entry into the Republic. We're indicating this, but this is also in alignment with what we have in the Immigration Act as well. If you look at your Section 23 permit, it does say, or visa, it does say that the person has then 5 days to travel to the nearest refugee reception office to submit his or her application. So it's alignment between the two acts. The asylum seeker who is not in possession of this asylum transit visa that I've now mentioned in terms of Section 23 of the Immigration Act, upon declaring the intention to seek asylum in the Republic, must give reasons why he or she is not in possession of such a visa, as this visa is a requirement. As I stated earlier, the intention is that anybody, that even people that want to apply for asylum, have to enter the Republic through a port of entry. At the port of entry, it is where you will receive the Section 23 visa, which would allow you then proceed to the refugee reception office to apply for asylum. If you're not in possession of it, there has to be questions as to why. It means that you did not come to the country via a port of entry. In addition, we're saying that the DG may, by notice in the Gazette, require any category of asylum seekers to report to any designated refugee reception office if it is deemed necessary for the proper administration of the Act. Asylum seekers are also required to declare all spouses and dependents, whether they're in the Republic of South Africa or not, as I indicated earlier. Hence, if one goes back to the definition of dependent, etc. The application for asylum must be rejected if it is found to contain false, dishonest, or misleading information. So anywhere where there's an element of dishonesty involved, that application should be rejected on that basis, because we want to work with real information and valid information before us, before granting an application. There's also a presumption that an applicant is proficient in the language that he or she indicated as the language of preference in his or her application. Because in this regard, and we get this in court cases as well, we say you need an interpreter. People will indicate that it's this language that they use, but it's not written down. So when we get to court, they say, no, but we didn't understand what the people were saying. So that we want the people to commit, they will write down what the specific language is, what they are proficient in. So when we do the necessary, or ask the necessary questions in order to deal with the application, they cannot come back and say that they did not understand. If you look at Section 21A of the current Act, which is Clause 16 of the Bill, we're dealing with unaccompanied child and persons with mental disability, and we're basically amending this clause in order to replace it with any person with a mental disability. What we want to say now is any person reasonably suspected to have a mental disability, because when you get to the person, it might not be immediately clear whether that person suffers from such a disability or not. So we're just creating space for ourselves to say that you can do that later on. If you look at Section 21B, which deals with the spouse and dependents of asylum seekers and refugees, which is Clause 17 of the Bill, there we're providing clarity that any child of an asylum seeker and any person included as a dependent, remember we changed the definition of dependent, have the same status as the asylum seeker concerned. Dependents whose dependency ceases, we say, may apply for asylum in their own names. So if you're dependent and your dependency ceases, you can apply on your own right, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be successful in that. But it can also mean that you will be successful. Chair, turning to Clause 18 of the Bill, which deals with Section 22 of the current Act relating to asylum seeker visas. Once again, we're mentioning the Wachanuka judgment here. And in terms of the Wachanuka judgment, made very clear that you must look at the individual circumstances of an asylum seeker. That must be considered. And that work or study, because that's what it related to, in order to maintain yourself, is not a matter of right. It's something that you have to look at. Now, in order to give effect to this approach, and also to clarify the requirements for obtaining work and study visas in South Africa, the following regulatory provisions have been included. One, the applicant may be assessed regarding the ability to sustain himself or herself and his or her dependents for a period of 4 months. If it is found that the applicant is unable to sustain himself or herself and his or her dependents, if there are any at that point in time, that asylum seeker may be offered shelter and basic necessities provided by the UNHCR. It's only after that you look at the right to work may not be endorsed on an asylum seeker visa if one is able to sustain himself or herself, is offered shelter and basic necessities by the UNHCR, or seeks to extend the right to work after failing to produce a letter of employment. And we'll get to that later on, where they have applied for employment and they don't provide the specific letter in this regard. Now, in order to confirm, it's just a continuation of Section 22, which is Clause 18 of the Bill, on the next page, or Slide 18. In order to confirm that rights to work or study are complied with, employers and educational institutions are obliged to provide the department with proof of this fact within 14 days of taking up such employment or being so enrolled. So we're placing an obligation on the employers and educational institutions in this regard, accepting people in this regard. Failure by these employers or educational institutions to comply with these or issuing fraudulent confirmations is an offence. We're creating that as an offence also in the bill. The DG also now has the power to revoke the right to work if we are not provided with a proof of employment after the 6 months of endorsement of the right to work. So if this person has an endorsement on his or her Section 22 visa to be allowed to work, we do not receive that offer of employment or proof of employment after 6 months. The DG has the right to revoke that work. An asylum seeker who fails to renew his or her asylum seeker visa after 1 month of expiry, obviously save for the reasons of hospitalization or institutionalization, which is obviously matters that are beyond the control of that specific individual, will be deemed to have been abandoned and will be dealt with as abandoned applications. Clauses 20, 21 and 22 of the bill, Honourable Chairperson and Members, deals with amendments to Sections 24, 24 capital A and 24 capital B of the current Act, and these relate to decisions regarding asylum seeker applications, reviews and appeals. Provision is made for SCRA now to also monitor and supervise decisions by your refugee status determination officers relating to the granting of asylum or finding of applications of unfounded. Currently, SCRA only deals with applications rejected as manifestly unfounded, abusive, or fraudulent. So we've added this monetary aspect to the supervisory oversight function to the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. Reviews in respect of your manifestly unfounded decisions may be done by any member of SCRA. In other words, this is where we're sitting with, you can sit as an individual member to hear reviews as the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. Remember in the 2008 Amendment Act, this power was given to the Director General when we did away with the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. Because we're bringing SCRA back now, obviously we're saying that they must do this review. The Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs must also inform the Refugee Status Determination Officer of its decision within 5 working days. We're putting that in the legislation in order to make sure that there's efficiency and people don't sit on these decisions end on end on end and they don't communicate the decisions to the, or the outcomes of the decisions to the applicants. Appeals relating to unfounded applications must be done within the prescribed period. So this obviously will then be done prescribed. We'll set that out in the regulations. Now, appeals is obviously relating to your appeal before the Refugee Appeals Authority, where an applicant has exercised the right or the decision to institute an appeal. It's not automatic, members, remember. If we look at Section 27 of the Act, turning to that's Clause 23 of the Bill, that deals with your general rights of your refugees. It's emerged that many of the asylum seekers in South Africa enter into marriages with South African nationals or permanent residents. And the reason for this is for the sole purpose of obtaining permanent residence permits. And we have the view that stricter regulation is required in this regard. If we look at Germany, for instance, there's an 8-year residency requirement. And if you look at the Namibian constitution in this regard, which has recently been amended, they provide for a 10-year requirement in this regard. So following on this, we are of the view that the following provisions should be included in the amendment bill, which we've done. Obviously, the period within which refugees are allowed to apply for permanent residence permits in terms of is now changed from 5 years to 10 years of continuous residence in South Africa. We've also now decided that the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, and not the Minister as it is currently, shall certify whether or not a person would remain a refugee indefinitely. The reason for that is that your Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs have all the information at hand, etc., which places them in a better position to, at the end of the day, decide whether or not, if you look at the country of origin reports, etc., whether this person will remain a refugee indefinitely. And in determining whether a person would remain a refugee, the SCRA would take into account, as I've indicated, relevant factors, including efforts made to secure peace and stability also in the refugee's country of origin. Chair, honourable members, if we turn to clause 24 of the bill, which deals with section 28 of the Act, which relates to the removal of refugee from the Republic, what we've done is the heading has been changed to remove reference to rights of refugees, as the provision does not deal with any rights. So it's just clearing up the current Act and making sure that what we're stating there is the correct facts. The provision now deals with the removal and detention of both asylum seekers and refugees, as well as their dependents from the Republic on grounds of national security, national interest, or of public order. Such removal, we indicate, may only be ordered by the minister. So it's not a unilateral decision by a refugee status determination officer. It's taken at a high level that the minister may order such a removal. Visas or status granted to refugees and asylum seekers will then be revoked by their removal. If they're removed, those visas will be revoked. Chair, turning to clauses 25 to 27 of the bill, which deals with sections 34 capital A and 36 of the current Act, and these in turn relate to the obligation of refugees, your asylum seekers, and also the withdrawal of refugee status. Both the asylum seekers and refugees are to inform the Refugee Reception Office of any change of address within 30 days. Currently, the Act doesn't provide any time period. It says that you must do it. But if you don't do it, what happens? People just don't do it. You don't have the latest address details, etc. So what we've done, in order to streamline the procedure regarding withdrawal of refugee status, what we've also done is to have the following provisions included. The power to withdraw a person's refugee status is now vested in the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, and not previously, as it is currently the case, which now with the minister currently. SCRA will do that now. I've mentioned that just in the previous slide. SCRA may also publish a declaration of cessation of refugee status of a category of refugees, and such publication will be in the Government Gazette, so that in order to avoid individual notification. So what will happen in this regard is if there's a cessation of refugee status for a category of refugees, what will do, there will be a publication in the Government Gazette indicating this, so that it's come to the knowledge of the public at large, which is a legal instrument in terms of the South African law. Persons whose refugee status has then been revoked will be dealt with in terms of the Immigration Act. So once your status has been revoked, you become an illegal foreigner, and in terms of the Refugees Act, you will be dealt with regarding deportation processes, etc. Chair, if we turn to clause 28 of the bill, which relates to section 37, it deals with offences, and we're adding a few additional offences to the existing offence that's already there in the Act. The first being public servants who provide false documentation or facilitate someone in disguising the identity or status or accepts a bribe will be an offence. Any person who produces a false certification in respect of any act that's administered by the department, or any person other than an official who manufactures a document purporting to be a document issued by the department, is now also an offence in terms of, and carries with it certain prescribed penalties. Thank you very much, Chair. That's the presentation at the end.
Thank you very much. Is there any rounding off statement, Deputy Minister?
No, Chair, except to say this. This area is a very, very dynamic area. We have more court applications out of this area than any other aspect of our operations. And very often this is about extension of rights to asylum seekers, particularly, and sometimes even failed asylum seekers. Now, the big problem that we have in our country is that, 90% of all applications that come into our refugee reception centres are actually rejected. So they're not genuine refugees. Our refugee population is actually very, very small, comparatively speaking, if you consider the number of applications we get. And part of the reason we get that many applications, of course, are the issues that we're trying to resolve with this piece of legislation, particularly the right to work and study in South Africa, etc. However, there have been certain developments since the tabling of this legislation. You would have seen, Chair, I sent to your office a recent judgment that we received in the Cape High Court, which from a reading of it seems to extend the rights of asylum seekers and failed asylum seekers to apply for any visas under the Immigration Act. Now this is seriously problematic, and our court seems to, as Advocate Erasmus stated in the presentation, seem to think that all asylum seekers are deserving of protection, when in fact the reality is 90% of them are not refugees. And very often these are the categories of people who would take us to court and find sympathy amongst judges. And part of the reason is quite understandable, because courts, unlike the executive and the legislature, can't see the big picture. They see the person in front of them, usually a poor person, usually somebody deserving of protection, etc. But the implications of those decisions have huge ramifications for us, both in terms of resources, in terms of security, but ultimately our ability to manage migration. So if you allow an asylum seeker who firstly entered the country without any documents, who basically wasn't an asylum seeker to begin with, just wants to stay in South Africa forever, because that's the motivation. If you allow that person more rights than you would a refugee. Now we have to think about this. If you have a refugee, somebody is a genuine person fleeing persecution, the Act currently says they must wait for 5 years. They must apply to SCRA to be declared a refugee indefinitely. So that's the first hurdle they have to climb. And if SCRA certifies them in terms of Section 27C, then only can they go and apply for a visa under the Immigration Act. But these judgments are now giving asylum seekers, some of whom have failed in their application, the right to just go ahead and apply for any visa in the country while they're in the country, including visitors' visas, which is just irrational. Visitors' visas in every country are issued abroad where you stay. If you want to travel to the UK tomorrow, Chair, you would go to the embassy of the UK here, apply for a visitors' visa so that you may be allowed to report at a port of entry in the UK. You're seen by an immigration officer who then stamps and certifies, okay, you did get a visa correctly, you can now come into the country. That's how it usually works. You can't be in the UK and then decide to apply for a visitor's visa. It just doesn't make sense. And this is exactly what is happening in our courts at the moment. And this is an aspect, I think, that the committee, we haven't provided for it because we've just recently received that judgment. But it is something in your deliberations, Chair, that we really urge the committee to think about in terms of formulating something that makes it very clear. We think that the law is clear as it is, but clearly our courts are not seeing it in that way, and we need to have a belts and braces clause to exclude that category of people from cross-pollination, as it were, into our migration system. Thank you, Chair, for your attention and for your time.
No, thank you very much. Honorable members, we have been listening. And there are particular challenges that are arising. The bill is about correcting some other things, strengthening the refugees' management, and also correcting certain wrong that may have happened in the past. And then there are a few things that I wanted to raise. We're talking about people to actually report to an office within 5 days of getting into the country. And then the issue that runs in my mind is that are we taking for granted that people that are fleeing from their countries will actually exit their home countries through a port of exit to be able to get into our port of entry immediately? Because our port of entry are close to the port of exit of the different countries. Are we saying that all of them then they will be exiting their home countries through their port of exit? And then if that is not the case, they enter somewhere in the middle of the Bundus, and then with no resources running away, what is the appropriate time that they will find themselves in our refugee reception office? That's what was just running in my head. And then also, of course, is this refugee appeals authority. Do we really have an establishment section of it, which actually deals with its terms and working conditions, and that there is clarity what these authorities do? And then another issue that was actually running through my mind was, if an RSDO gives an individual or grant the refugee status, then SCRA later find that that decision is not right. Legally, how do we handle that? These were the things that were just running in my mind as you were proceeding. And also possibilities of a person who adopts people in Zimbabwe to be his dependents, and immediately after adopting them, then decides to run with them into South Africa and say, oh, they are my dependents. And then checks and balances. Honorable Fidlan.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Well, first of all, I just want to understand on page 19, where you say SCRA must do the supervision and monitoring. But before that, I think SCRA was scrapped to get in another name. Now, I just want to understand why we're bringing SCRA back to do the supervision against the RSDO if they made a decision and then that decision is not right, then they appeal. So if you can make me understand on that one. The second question that I want to ask, I think it's similar to the chairperson's question. If you go around and find out that the Home Affairs is short of staff, now talking into the 5 days of entry into the country, do you think the refugee section in particular can look after, maybe if you talk about 100 people and you're short of staff in your department of refugee, now that 5 days, is it enough for those people to do the application? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. We can see, Chairperson, that a lot of work has been done, and the department has put more effort around this refugee amendment bill. Then, checking on slide 5 of the presentation, Chairperson, we all know that human dignity is enshrined in the South African Constitution, giving the case, the Watchnuwa case, which held that the freedom to engage in productive work is an important component of our human dignity. Won't removing the right to work for the asylum seekers be questioned as unconstitutional and against the court ruling? And then, Chairperson, my second question would be regarding page 19 of the presentation. Just wanted to get clarity from the department if it's realistic to expect application for asylum to happen within 5 days of entry, given the current situation and foreseeable shortage of staff in the department and refugee section in particular, then what will happen about that? Then my last question, Chairperson, is around clause 8 of the bill. I just want to check what is the difference intended by substituting. There is a substituting of the word consider there for the word deem. In terms of numbers of members of appeals authority, considering the appeal, then what's the aim of substitution that we consider for deem? Maybe if I can get clarity on if that special question can be clarified. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
And I do commend.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Firstly, let me thank the department for this intervention. It is a necessary intervention as we are public representatives when acting as members of parliament. We interact with our constituencies and we realize that our constituency differentiates between a refugee and an economic migrant. South Africans are in a difficult economic situation as I speak. South Africans are unemployed. South Africans are looking for as much resources from the taxpayer as possible. We've got we are custodians of the taxpayer, and the taxpayer doesn't have unlimited resources. The resources have got to be we have to be in a situation to estimate for our budgets and to estimate for the infrastructure we provide. Therefore, we cannot be in a situation where everybody is regarded as a refugee as long as they come from a foreign country. Some refugees definitely are economic migrants. They compete with South Africans for jobs and means of survival, and therefore, as members of the parliament, we've got to take that into account. And the right to work and the right to study should be for people, our own citizens and people that are in our country because they are genuine refugees. Other people really then can be considered given the state of our economy. And therefore, I suggest that we do have an effective system to regulate the refugees. The number has been given as 170,000 people per annum, which is much more than 10,000 people per month. And definitely, we have to make sure that we change our systems in order to be able to accommodate those numbers, because we have been told by the department that the number of cases that they have to address is unmanageable given the resources, capacities, and systems that they are running. And therefore, it is our duty to look seriously into such a legislation. The issue of decisions, we've got to have the best decisions possible for the situation, looking at the United Nations provisions, looking at our constitution, looking at our law, and therefore come up with decisions that are to the satisfaction of our constituency, and our constituency is South Africans, South African citizens. Yes, we have to support refugees, but I don't think we can support all economic migrants coming into South Africa. That is where we come from, and therefore, if we combat corruption, we are on the side of our public. If we combat corruption, we are on the side of our taxpayer. Therefore, any measure that is constitutional, that is legal, that combats corruption, we have to support as members of this legislation. And in that spirit, we accept that the legislation has taken us quite an effective, that it gives us quite an effective instrument to manage. However, there is space for submissions. We have had hundreds of submissions from do-gooders, which is, we are happy to have submissions of that nature. Although perhaps all the emails have been had the same content, perhaps it was a way of emphasis. We are going to look into that, but in looking into that, we've got to make sure that we increase efficiencies, we improve the quality of our decisions, and then we reduce the level of corruption. And lastly, Chairperson, I thank the department and all those people that have made submissions, that it is a patriotic duty. We are happy we are going to consider all submissions, but at the same time, it is our obligation to represent the public. Otherwise, Parliament will become irrelevant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kumalo. And let me just also just go through some of the pages. On page 10, if we have granted a status to an individual, and this individual commits a criminal act, then we say we can withdraw. And then when you withdraw, what do you do with the individual? Does the criminal activity changes the status of a person? If a person is running away from Syria now, he comes in here, then he steals or kills somebody in a bar, in a lodge, does that change the status in Syria that he cannot be deported back to Syria? What then happens when after you withdraw the status? If we can just have a little bit of clarity. What will fall when you do that on a person that is deserving the status? Then the issue that we are now extending, that the DG would establish and disestablish a reception office. Then is there any certainty that we can establish that the DG would disestablish a reception office under the following reason? That to create some sort of certainty to a certain extent, under which he, because of course now he's a man, and then if it changes in future, and then the gender will change as well. If, you know, just giving some sort of certainty under which can disestablish an office, or whether we just simply want to empower him to disestablish as and when he feels like, then something may be a little bit difficult. Then the issue of where am I? 17, where we are actually implicating UNHCR. What is there that we have that makes us to say this? Is there bullet number 2? Is there anything that empowers us or informs us to implicate the UNHCR that they will offer shelter and basic necessities to these kind of people if they can't sustain themselves for the period of 4 months or whatever? Then there is this other issue of an employer to report or proof of employment or whatever, or educational institutions as well to report. If these persons, because most of them that comes in, we have seen them working in the informal trade. Some of them, I think, you walk in Cape Town in the middle of the night, you'll find them in small little cars, and then operating some meter taxis. And then some, of course, is that they are mechanics and under the tree in the rural areas and all that. What is that will happen under those kind of circumstances, where a person comes in and then he goes and work for a backyard mechanic? Whether they keep on stripping other people's cars or what, I don't know, but working in a backyard mechanic, and then under those kind of circumstances, is it still going to be an offense from that particular employer, although it's an informal employer? And of course, is that we have seen many of these people in at the shopping complexes trying to manage parking, especially around Cape Town. I think in every shopping complex, then those that are trying to marshal parking, I'm sure around about 75% to 80% or 90% are foreigners, and I don't know. And then, of course, is that you also have this situation of labor brokers that the unions are worried about, where you've got these particular persons, especially in the security, industry, and like as I'm saying, also in the complexes, where you find that those people that are manning our cars in the parking or in the security, they are actually employees of a labor broker, and then giving a service to somebody else, who then actually take the blame or the offense in those kind of things. Then we're changing the period from 5 years to 10 years, where a person can apply for permanent residence for having stayed in the country. Then if we change it to 10 years, those that currently qualifies under the 5 years, on the time of effect of this amendment, are they going to be affected? That means it's a retrospective, or those that are qualifying now, by the time this particular legislation is implemented, will they continue to be considered on the previous 5 year term? Or it will be a retrospective. Also, I would have loved to hear whether this bill will provide for, if you just walk into Khayelitsha, then you find a person that that is a refugee there, and either is having an expired refugee visa, let's say those that you get at the port of entry that actually facilitates them to get to the reception office, doesn't go there. You find a person in the middle of Khayelitsha, 6 months down the line. What happens? What does the bill say it must do with those kind of people? Or you find them in the middle of Bloemfontein, because I've been informed that in the middle of Bloemfontein you'll find a lot of people that are not having documents, that are just coming from neighboring states, some in the old mines there doing some illegal mining. And you know, what is this particular bill talking to those kind of people that have some sort of a refugee document that is no longer holding? Is there anything that empowers the department then to act when we get those kind of people? Let me say that these questions, they may look like endless, but it is the nature of the bill, because it is directly related to service delivery, and there are many, many, many people that are affected by the work that is based on this particular bill. And we do expect, as Honorable Gumede has indicated, that we expect a lot of submissions to come our way, and we will pay attention to. The likelihood is that we may take longer to finish this particular bill. It may take longer because there is a lot of interested parties, and some from outside the country, some from inside the country. You know that there is a lot of private business that is also involved in this particular area of refugees, and we will definitely have a lot of interested parties coming in, and so we will actually raise ourselves, even if it means going to a gym, you know, to be able to actually deal with this thing, then we'll subscribe to some gym so that we are actually physically ready to actually deal with this particular man. Deputy Minister, we have heard you, then we have tried to make your job a little bit difficult. Probably you'll be able to fend some of those things that we have raised to really actually empower ourselves to be able to deal with this particular matter. Of course, we just need to indicate that we have advertised the bill or invited people to make submissions, and then from the 9th of this particular month, and then we expect the closing date to be on the 28th of this month. And we hope that all those that are interested will do so, and then so that they have the opportunity And of course is that one thing for sure is that we may not be able to have all of them to come here and speak to us. But the submissions will be looked at, and some of the submissions will warrant people to come and present here so that we actually interrogate, because some other submissions, given the experience of other bills, is that you'll find an interested person just speaks to one particular clause, and it is very clear what that person is saying. There's no real need for the person to come and speak to us. But there are those that actually indulge themselves, you know, to go through the whole bill and look at each and every clause, and sometimes becomes unclear what is there that this particular person wants to say. Then those are some of the people that we may need to come and clarify themselves in front of us, and then so that we really understand what they're trying to say. And we hope that we'll try to do in as many official languages as possible, because this particular bill is running across all provinces. And then even the provinces that are inland, like Gauteng, that are actually enclosed by other provinces on the border, they do have our offices. They serve our people and foreigners on this. So almost each and every province has got an interest. And so we'll try to make sure that it is in all languages. But I mean, all these rights, they are limited by the availability of resources as well. You may proceed, Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. Before I begin, maybe I would just want to address certain of the questions that members have posed to the officials. I think the issue of the RAA versus the RAB, the officials can deal with that. What happens when somebody's visa has expired and you find them still in the country? What does the bill say about that? When somebody adopts a child in Zimbabwe and then claims that that person is a dependent, what does the bill say about those things? I think that's basically the issues, and of course any other issues that the officials want to raise is fine. Perhaps we begin, Chairperson, with the questions that you posed up front, which hopefully will address also the five-day issue that was raised by both Member Mnisi and Friedman. But maybe I should just underscore what the Honourable Gumede has said. I think we want to emphasize that in principle we are not opposed to foreign nationals coming into South Africa to work. What we are opposed to is the usurping of the asylum system to do so. Because we have an immigration system that people must make use of should they wish to come and work in South Africa or run businesses or join their families. We have several different visas that people have to qualify for. And what we're finding more and more is that the asylum system seems to offer a conduit towards achieving the same objectives for such migrants, and therefore they opt to use the asylum system either in the first instance or actually having failed in their application for visas would then use the asylum system to obviate the provisions of the immigration system. So I think it's important for us to underscore that point, that under no circumstances are we opposed to foreign nationals coming to work in South Africa. In fact, we process applications for foreign nationals to come and work in South Africa every single day. I think the other thing that we would want to underscore is that the the refugee system is a concession that we make because we wish to be part of this global effort to ensure that the world is a more caring place, particularly for people who face situations of war, of persecution, and where their human rights and dignity are in fact in jeopardy. And this we do not alone as South Africa, but we do it as a as part and parcel of a family of nations, all of whom are meant to shoulder the burden of refugees and asylum seekers. So that is very important that we understand this, that we are not an island. We operate with our sister countries to ensure that we meet our obligations insofar as asylum seekers and refugees are concerned. Having said that, Chair, let me come to the specific questions that you pose up front. You pose the question of people fleeing their countries and whether they would arrive at ports of entry to begin with. And I think that's a very important question that you pose. Up to now, we have not demonstrated a selective approach between those people who actually do arrive at ports of entry and those who don't. And what this legislation is seeking to do is to mark that differentiation. It is true that many asylum seekers do report to our ports of entry, and we do issue the Section 23 visa at the ports of entry. When people report to the ports of entry and say to us, I am an asylum seeker, I want to come to South Africa to apply for asylum, we immediately at the port of entry will issue that Section 23 visa, which is valid for 5 days. And all it does, the 5 days does not mean that we have to process the applications within 5 days. It means the person from the time they've left the port of entry to the time they report to the refugee reception office, we give them 5 days. If they come on day six, they are in violation of that visa. It's a free pass to say, go ahead, go and report to a port of entry. There is no place, no refugee center in South Africa that can take longer than 5 days to arrive at. There isn't such a place. And we think 5 days is optimal, and we think it's necessary given that very often we have not done the kind of security checks and screening of the individual that we have allowed into the country. We've allowed them simply because there is an exception to our immigration system that says if you're an asylum seeker, you should be allowed to come and apply and make your case, in other words, to be a refugee. In this legislation, what we now do, as I say, is we try and differentiate between those who arrive at the port of entry and those who don't. Those who don't will present themselves at our refugee reception center without that visa, without the Section 23 visa. When such a case happens, we must be mindful of the convention. The convention allows people who are literally fleeing for their lives, and they simply, because they are in flight, cannot possibly present themselves at a port of entry, such as the situation that you were articulating, Chip. So if I am somebody in Botswana, for example, and I feel that I'm being persecuted, but I cannot, for fear of being apprehended by the authorities on the Botswana side, present myself to a port of entry. What I will do is I will try and find a way to arrive in South Africa outside of that port of entry. And what this law says, as long as you can satisfy an immigration officer that the reason for your entering South Africa illegally, because we have an immigration law that says every person who comes into South Africa shall do so at a port of entry. As long as you can satisfy the immigration officer that there is some basis that is linked to your asylum application that gave rise to your fleeing across the border in that way. So I often make the example to say somebody who is in a neighboring country, one would assume that there is possibly such a reason that gave rise to the person fleeing across the border in that way. Because there might have been a hot pursuit, people might have been looking for this individual to persecute them or whatever the issue is. But if it is somebody who is, for example, from East Asia, somebody who is a Bangladeshi national, who comes into the country via Mozambique, but comes over the border illegally, the question then arises rationally. What could have motivated such an entry into South Africa? Surely if you're persecuted, you're persecuted in Bangladesh, not in Mozambique. So there should be no reason ostensibly, unless such a reason is indicated. But on the face of it, there should be no reason why that person should not have come to a port of entry and declared themselves up front. So what this legislation does is, if such a person arrives without that visa, before being allowed to apply for asylum, before filling in the application at the refugee reception center, that person is meant to be interviewed by an immigration officer. And that person has to indicate a reason why they've come into the country illegally. So that's really what we provide for in this legislation, Chairperson. What do we do? Well, the 5 years to 10 years, I would imagine the lawyers can respond to that, but I would imagine that it can't be retrospective. So it would only be once the law is passed by Parliament, signed into law by the President, that new applicants for asylum will then be accorded that particular provision. So the existing batch will all fall under the old law. What do you do when the person commits a crime and now you want to revoke their status? That's a very, very good question. And I'm not quite sure myself whether this would be something that we wouldn't have to deal with on a case-by-case basis. Let's assume the person is granted refugee status on the basis that they're being persecuted in their country. Then the person commits robbery or murder in the country and is then found guilty, because this only comes into play once the person is convicted. Right? So the person is now found guilty in a court of law. What will then happen is that person will go to jail. That's the first thing that will happen. And ordinarily, migrants who come into our country, who commit crimes and go to jail, we strip them of their visa status. And this is just aligning that process to the asylum system as well. What will happen if the person serves their term of imprisonment and then is released either on parole or whatever the issue is? Firstly, our undertaking and our point of departure is that they should not be considered for parole to the extent that they pose an imminent danger to society. This is a person, remember, who was, if I may use this analogy, he'd come to visit you in your house. You invited him in. You said, come and stay in my house. And then he committed a crime against you. This is very, very serious indeed. And this is not something I think that should be taken lightly by parole boards, etc. But let's assume for argument's sake, the full sentence is served and the person is now released. What then happens? Our contention is that on a case-by-case basis, we would have to discuss with the UNHCR either that the person be taken or the charge of that person is being taken over by the UNHCR, or that that person is resettled in another country. As I said, this is something that we'll have to negotiate on a case-by-case basis. But we don't think, Chairperson, that it's correct for people who come to visit us in our home to commit crimes and then continue being visitors in your home. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that principle. So the question remains, in a sense, unanswered, but it is something we think that we should take a stance on insofar as the refugee status is concerned. It may be that we would be forced to offer the person some other kind of status, but not refugee status. The disestablishment, should we give direction, really is what you've been asking, Chairperson. The establishment of offices falls within the realm of an executive power, we've always argued, because there are monetary considerations. So, for example, if the Director General wants to open an ordinary Office of Home Affairs somewhere, there shouldn't necessarily be anything in law that prevents him from doing so, except that there is this understanding that his decision must be a rational one. So he can't possibly go and open a home affairs office, let's say, in the middle of the Kalahari Desert or something of that sort, where there's nobody living. I mean, that would be completely irrational. But at the same time, we believe that there are certain things that fall within the executive purview that, and that terrain is constantly changing. So, for example, we may decide to go to town X because it's very remote and the people can't access a home affairs office in a city that is 200 kilometers away. The nearest city is 200 kilometers away. So we go to that town and we establish a home affairs office there, only to find that actually most of the people there are not using the office, because there is an exodus out of that town over a period of time. And you find that the population is so remote that the cost doesn't justify us being there. In which case, there should be this opportunity for the DG to disestablish such an office, because it's not cost effective. And we're saying, by the same token, you can translate that to hospitals, you can translate it to schools, all manner of services that government offers. There should be that flexibility to either establish or disestablish at any given point. Unfortunately, this particular amendment has been, as a result of, again, a court interpretation, as you are well aware, Chairperson, relating to our refugee reception center in Port Elizabeth, which we honestly don't understand, because there's no reason for refugees or asylum seekers, most of whom come to our Pretoria Refugee Reception Center, and we've shown you as the Portfolio Committee the statistics that 70% of all asylum seeker applications are processed there, notwithstanding the fact that our largest category are Zimbabweans, and we have a refugee center in Musina, which is quite near that port of entry. But still people choose to come to Pre. We have no problems with that, but we simply do not understand the rationale to say that we must have a refugee center for all time in Port Elizabeth. It's not cost effective, it's being abused, and it has been abused, as members of the Portfolio Committee know already. And we really cannot understand why we are meant to, and the courts have decided that we must have such a presence in Port Elizabeth. It is for this reason, and I must just say to you, this is not going to take away the decision of the Supreme Court as it stands, but this is a way of clawing back, in a sense, that executive authority that permits the establishment, and we would have thought by implication the disestablishment. But here we're just making that very, very clear. Insofar as the issue of discerning between those asylum seekers who will be given the opportunity to work and study while awaiting the outcome of their application versus those who will not. So let us go back to Honorable Nisi's question, which says, what Chanukah reinforced the dignity of people and their right to work? Well, let me just say that nobody has a right to come to work in South Africa except South Africans. That's your first point of departure. There is no right in the Constitution that allows for that, because if there was, well, frankly, we might as well just close up shop and not manage migration into the country. So what Chanukah was very, very specific, and I really want to urge members to read that judgment carefully. Mrs. What Chanukah was a single mother with many young children. She had been waiting for her application for asylum to be processed for many, many years, and in that time she was unable to look after her children. And it was in that case that the court said, in her case, she should have been allowed to work while awaiting the outcome of her application. Now, two things have changed since that time. Well, let me just say, the interpretation by the SCRA at that time was that they would just afford everybody the right to work and study in South Africa, whoever applied for asylum, and that really created the problem to begin with in terms of the numbers of people who then flooded our asylum system. Two things have happened. The first is that we know that not everybody who presents themselves in our reception center is the profile of a Mrs. Machinuka. You've said yourself, Chairperson, that people come here and they establish businesses the next day. These people are resourced. Why do we have to give them the right to work while they are awaiting the outcome of their application? The second thing that has changed is that you no longer wait for 3 or 5 years or even 1 year for your application to be processed. The benchmark is 3 months. In exceptional circumstances, and I mean really exceptional circumstances, and Manda would be able to tell you a little bit about those exceptional circumstances, you may find that somebody takes up to 6 months to be processed because it's a complicated matter or whatever the issue is. But for the most part, we are talking maximum 3 months. In places like Mosina and in Durban, you can get your decision on the same day that you made your application. So we don't think that this is an unnecessary hardship. As for the UNHCR, they do currently, Chairperson, provide shelter, accommodation, and other services to both asylum seekers as well as refugees who are destitute in the country. Their service is also of an interim nature. So what they do is they have shelters around the country sometimes through their operating partners and so on, churches, NGOs, etc., where destitute asylum seekers and refugees are assisted. So they are accommodated. They are sometimes offered training, skills, etc., etc., and then they are weaned into becoming more independent over a period of 6 months or a year or whatever. Why should those people then be afforded the right to work while they are awaiting the outcome of their application? Because they are able to get a roof over their heads, and they are getting a plate of food 3 times a day. In addition to other things. So that is really the rationale. Now, remember, in that particular section, the issue is the UNHCR is not required to provide the shelter. They may do so. And should they opt to do so in a particular person's case, let's say a Mrs. Wachanuka with her children arrives today at our reception center, we would ask the UNHCR person there, please can you provide accommodation and food for these people while their application is being processed. If the UNHCR says yes, well, no problem. Person can go, stay in the shelter, children are looked after and even provided education and so on, preschool, etc. If the UNHCR says no, and Mrs. Wachanuka can show us that in fact she's got no resources to feed her children, well then, we will still grant her the ability to work while she is awaiting the outcome of her application. All we are doing by this proposal, Chairperson, is saying it's not a matter of right that when you apply for asylum, you will get a work visa. And this has been the problem with the current system. I am not sure if I have covered everything. Ah, yes, informal employers. Thank you, Chairperson. I've just been reminded about your other question about informal employment, running informal trade, and so on. Understand, Chairperson, that our visas talk about work and study. We do not aim to regulate businesses. In fact, if you look at the immigration laws, there's a specific visa that you have to apply for if you want to run a business. We do recognize that there is a reality on the ground that informal trading is very unregulated in our country. But that, unfortunately, is not something that Home Affairs can solve, because we have never given people the right to run businesses. We have given them the right to work and or study, and work in the formal sense, which is why we then talk about employers giving us a letter of employment, etc., etc., within a specific period after hiring an individual. We have been in discussions with local government under whose offices informal trade should be regulated, and you have different metros, different local municipalities having different level of regulations and, in fact, applying it in a very different manner from each other. And this is one area, I think, that has to be tightened up, but it can't be done by Home Affairs. The second issue relates to trade and industry and labor. Department of Labor, insofar as informal employment is concerned, clearly has its own laws that it administers and has to implement those laws. Likewise, insofar as it pertains to trade and industry, there needs to be a framework against which we believe that all businesses, whether formal or informal, ought to be registered. Don't need to have a huge amount of red tape for that to happen, but it does seem to me to be unsustainable for people to merely arrive today and tomorrow open up a business without any form of regulation whatsoever. It doesn't happen in other countries. It should not happen here. And likewise, this is a responsibility for the Department of Trade and Industry. I must say, to their credit, there was a bill about a year ago that they had introduced, 2 years ago, I can't remember, but they've since withdrawn, and I'm not quite sure what the reason for that is, and perhaps you might want to speak to your counterpart in Trade and Industry about that. But insofar as it pertains to Home Affairs, clearly, you know, we can't prevent people from doing things that are not regulated in the country. We're not an omnibus type of department. So I thought I would just then deal with those aspects and see if Mandla, Henny, Dion, wish to add anything.
We have a speech enough.
Thank you, DM, and thank you, Chairperson, and the members of the committee. I will take some of the questions and allow them, my colleagues, to respond to some of those. And I'll start with the question, Chairperson, that we have asked in relation to those asylum seekers with expired permits. What happens to them? We have provided in the legislation that after a given period of time, those applications should be considered as abandoned, and therefore the permit would have expired as well because the client is not coming to our office. And then we then say the immigration processes should kick in. That means then that person would be considered as under the Immigration Act, and it's provided for in terms of section under clause 18, section 12 and 13, 22, 12 and 13, yeah. I don't know if you wish us to read it, but I don't think it's a long paragraph, but it's provided there. Yes, and then also in terms of the Principal Act, when it relates to the supervision of the work of the RSDOs, the Principal Act of 1998 provide for SCRA to supervise the work of the RSDOs, but only as it relates to the manifestly unfounded cases, abusive, or the work related to SCRA, the review cases. But then we felt that limits SCRA in terms of providing that supervision, because if SCRA is going to supervise and advise the department in terms of the training interventions that are required, then SCRA will then have to get a better view of what is happening under or within the centers themselves. They must know what kinds of decisions that are taken in relation to granting, and what kinds of decisions or claims that are informing the unfounded decisions that relate to the appeal, for SCRA to be able to advise the department fully. So we then felt that we need to bring those elements, but they were already there in relation to the review cases that fall under SCRA.
But just related to the same, what I'm saying is that if the RSDO actually grant, and then SCRA finds that no, it has been granted wrongfully, legally, what happens? How do you manage that? Because already there is an expectation that has been created on one side, and then that, but now you have to reverse it. SCRA's decision then is actually seeking to reverse, a decision that has been made by the RSDO. How do you actually deal with that legally when such a matter arises? I think that's the one question that was alluded to that particular section.
Okay, thanks for the reminder. You are correct. Currently, under the current Principal Act, once the refugee status is granted by the RSDO, it doesn't go to SCRA, and therefore the person is given the refugee status. But however, throughout our review processes and monitoring, once we realize that the status was issued erroneously, we then subject that or that status to Section 36 of the Act, to review and inform the client that we intend to withdraw that status. If the client then has an objection to that withdrawal, the client is given 30 days to respond to the letter from SCRA.
Chair, you've asked quite a difficult question about people, giving the example of Zimbabweans who adopt a whole family and then cross the border and they seek asylum. Well, I'm not sure that we can do much about that scenario, because if a person can prove that he or she has an adopted child, it has to be recognized in terms of our law. That person has to be recognized as a dependent, of course, subject to the fact that it can be proved. or that person will probably be required, if there's no paperwork to prove that, will have to make an affidavit to that regard. But I don't have a particular solution to that question, unless some of the other colleagues may assist me. I just want to, you asked the question, Honourable Member, about the reason for changing the word deemed to consider in Section 8. I think were you referring to Section 8C of the Act? It is not something that we ourselves as the team suggested should be done. It is the latest writing style of the state law advisors who they wanted this change, and it is not coming from us. Deem versus consider, I think what they are probably thinking about is that deem seems a little bit archaic, and therefore they change it to consider. It doesn't necessarily alter the meaning of what is intended here. But yeah, as I say, this comes from the state law advisors. I'm not sure if there was another question that I may have missed.
Thank you very much. Just with regard to the question, you posed the question with regard to Refugee Appeals Authority, if there's any specific establishment clause, etc. Yes, Chair, there is indeed. If you look at Section 8, capital A to F of the Act, we in detail deal with how it's established, the composition, the meetings, etc., etc., how they serve our core. So that is indeed something that forms part of the legislation. Chair, I've ticked all the questions that I've noted down as having been answered here. I think that, that's it.
Thank you very much for having responded to that, and I'm sure the state law advisors wants to tell us whether they've seen this bill, and when you say that they advocated and then it is correct, you may have a chance to speak.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair, thank you. We've indeed seen we've seen the bill, and we agreed that it is constitutionally sound. I just wanted to perhaps confirm also what the Deputy Minister said in relation to the retrospectivity of the bill. It's not intended that it has retrospective effect. So if we wanted it to be retrospective, we would have specifically, you know, required the department to state so in the bill, but it wasn't. So it would have to only apply from the date that it commences. That's now in respect of those changes to the amount of residence years. And then in respect of the word consider that we changed, well, the theme that we changed to consider, as rightly stated by Advocate Potgieter, it's just a drafting style and format matter. So many of the old bills still use the word deem, and since we also have what we call deeming provisions in some legislation, it might cause confusion. So in recent legislation, I would say mostly after 94, we started to rather use the word consider than deem, just to avoid any confusion, so that it's not, we try to do away with those archaic terms. So it wasn't really a big issue there in that section when we changed it. Thank you, Chair.
Well, English is not it's not my first language.
No.
But, you know, it's when we speak about consider, and then you've got two roots. When you consider, then there are two roots. Either one agree or the other one you don't agree. Does the team still means that? And I don't know. And then English is my fourth language, if not sixth language. Then the English specialist then will assist. You see, the main thing is that the majority of people that read that must have a similar interpretation of that provision. Once it actually splits people into halves or into different directions in interpreting it, then it causes confusion. And I think that's what we just need to be assisted. And honorable members, do you still have any other question? Or you are satisfied or satisfied? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Peg is fired. And that document.
No, in fact, I just wanted to know, for purposes of planning, what is the program from here regarding with this legislation?
It's a very difficult question. because I'm sure it's like, as I tried to spell out, that this is going to be reasonably a lengthy process, given the interest that one expects. You'll remember the number of submissions received when we were trying to correct that constitutional issue, one sentence. But then we received so many submissions. Therefore, now with this one, bringing all sorts of dynamics, you know, and then you can see that a lot of people are going to be affected, and they would like to make their voices heard. And remember that some of the voices, like as I'm saying, some of them, they are in the interest of the country, some are in the interest of the client, some are in the interest of their own businesses, all sorts of things. And then, but then they will come, all of them, objectively to us to process. And of course, is that we still have the BMA that we are processing. And then, which means is this one as well will now have to feature in. But the closing date for us to be able to start with the public hearings will be after the end of this month. And remember that will be the last month as well that we'll be having here. The possibilities that we'll be the most likeliest people if we really find ourselves close to finishing it in this session. It may spill into next year if we are intended to do our best to actually make sure that we really don't leave people outside, and again is that we get as close to a constitutionally accepted draft. Of course, is that you'll never make everybody happy at any given time, but the intent is that one. And then the deputy minister, the issue of the right or the power, the executive power to disestablish a reception office. One just thinks that initially it will be in the interest of the department to expand or access. But once that access has been established, to remove it, then you've got too many people to cry. You'll have too many people to cry. And therefore, that's why I was just thinking that if we have to actually guard the conditions or the reasons under which the DG will disestablish an office, actually deny, even if it is few people, remember that you may be saving 100 persons a month, and all of a sudden it goes down to only 10. But that 10 will have a right to complain, why are you closing the office? Now, that's why I was just simply saying that for us to actually create some sort of a framework, you know, it may not be 100%, but at least it gives the direction under which the DG will disestablish an office. And whether it's in the best interest or whatever. And then so that even if anybody goes to court, then the court will actually close by and say, this is the area in which the DG has considered to close this office as it is provided in the piece of legislation. And then establish whether the reasons that are given at that particular time, it is in that particular area. Because at the moment, if it is just a blank power given, if it lands in court, the court will just simply widen its consideration. And like as we're saying, is what is common sense to others is rocket science, blah, blah. you know, is that the scale is the value system, then it is different. And probably we may be facing the same reason why the court has actually decided otherwise in these recent cases, because when it looks at it, it's just a field, and the Act is not providing some sort of guidance under which these kind of decisions will be taken. That's what I was just simply going to say, you know, if the department can just think about it, if it makes sense, then we provide just what that one sentence is. If it doesn't make sense, well, then we may move like that. You wanted to say something?
No, it was actually remiss of me not to point out, Chair, that the legislation does provide that one sentence that you're looking for.
Yeah.
So as it stands now, it says that the DG may establish and disestablish any refugee reception office by notice in the Gazette if considered necessary for the proper administration of this act. So that we think is broad enough, but also gives this issue of rationality some teeth as well.
Okay.
But also, Chair, let me just point out to you that this is not just in response to what has happened with regard to the PE thing. It also must apply for all future eventualities. So, for example, if tomorrow there's civil war in Swaziland, for example, and we have a huge number of people moving into South Africa, the DG should be able to establish very quickly refugee reception centers to deal with that influx. At the same time, when that influx dissipates, we should be able to then remove those. Thank you, Chair.
I've just noted that example of Swaziland. something that may be likely. I think let's appreciate the briefing that we have received, and also we will do all the logistical arrangements to facilitate its consideration, and we will keep contact on the areas that when we have applied our mind on it, that we still feel that there is no clarity, so that when we come and undertake the public hearings, then we should be clear what is there that the department intends to do, and then those that are actually arguing otherwise, then we'll be able to interact with them a little bit efficiently. And then we really need to thank the presentation, and thank you, the Deputy Minister, for having led that and making very, very, very serious, meaningful input in this particular bill. And also thank the presence of the two musketeers at the end. And that work that we have put in to assist the department to produce a bill that can stand the test, I think we appreciate that. Honorable members, I think we need to really appreciate also your presence to help to be able to undertake this particular work. Those our visitors and from the media led by events, we appreciate that as well, and we hope that you will communicate correctly to the public, and we have not said nobody has said that we are closing all borders, nobody must walk in. We have never said that. And also nobody has said that, no, we are just opening it for everybody to come in. Nobody has said that. So things have been put here that will actually manage and govern that part of that kind of territory, and that it should be reported correctly. Thank you very much from my side, and there is no reason for us to continue in this meeting, and this meeting stands adjourned. What do you mean?
Yeah.